ladies and gentlemen, we're in the Delaware Valley. Welcome to Salt's Mongoluzzi Bendeschi Hour. We've got a fantastic show on WWDB Talk 860. I'm your co-host, Joe Dougherty. From Salt's Mongoluzzi and Bendeschi, we have Ara Avrigan. How are you, Ara?
I'm doing great.
And we have Drew Heinold. How are you, Drew?
I'm good. Happy to be here.
That's great to have you. And certainly, we're going to be talking about a number of things. I say this, and I've said it at the beginning of each show, the White House was designed as an unfair advantage to foreign heads of state. Well, look at where we are right now, right? You got to feel like you're defeated already if you're on the other team and coming up here. We're on the 52nd floor of Liberty One. Truth be told, I was a union iron worker, so I know this, that the skyline from right where we're sitting right here. So, okay. Pretty cool stuff.
It's a nice place to work.
It is. I remember the day we went above Billy Penn's hat. Now, I wasn't on this job, but they had what you call a top and out party, which means, and you know how with a big city and not willing to go over Billy Penn's hat. I mean, literally, it was an issue for years.
Big deal.
Big deal. I was working on a high rise up the street, and all my buddies as I was walking, so many years ago, waving, they were doing their party, and the rest is history, man. Look at the skyline now.
It's really nice.
And so you guys, not only a part of history, but this is an incredible, we'll talk about the Bruce Springsteen exhibit later on. Having said that, if you will, tell our listeners a little bit about yourself and a little bit about how you got where you're at right now.
Sure. Well, I came out of law school, and I was actually doing medical malpractice defense work, defending doctors in hospitals and malpractice cases. And the precursor to this firm, Salt's Mongoluzzi, was actually some of my adversaries in a few cases.
Which is not unusual, by the way, right?
No, not terribly. But even though we were adversaries, we were very professional and got along. And after about 5 years into doing my defense work, one of the partners here approached me about joining this firm and really switching sides in the type of litigation I was doing, going from defense work to plaintiff work. And it was a great opportunity. I took that opportunity up and joined this firm, and been here about 25 years since then. It's been a great 25 years, learned a lot, helped a lot of clients, and it's been a great place to work, a great career.
And having said that, Drew, if you would...
Yeah, I'm a seventh-year associate at the firm, and this is the only place I've worked since law school. I actually got involved here as a law clerk. My dad is a defense, or he's retired now, but was a defense attorney at one of the firms here, and he, he was an adversary of many of the attorneys here, and that's kind of how I got my foot in the door as a law clerk, and having the opportunity to learn under, fantastic lawyers, and, being under R for the past 7 years, having that opportunity, I kind of fought for it as a law clerk, and luckily, was able to get a job and been here since.
Awesome. And I've heard a number of attorneys say the same thing, successful attorneys who worked, a lot of people cut their teeth on the defensive side and worked a career, and adversaries and finally the other team said, why don't you work for us? You're doing a good job. It's a great, sign of mutual respect. And
yeah, I took it as a compliment.
Of course. They're not going to hire somebody that, the best way to get rid of this guy is to have him join us.
Right.
But that's an awesome thing. Let's talk a little bit about, with the listeners, about the team, what you guys do here, because you have there's different teams here. As you guys know, we did the Mass Tort team on the last broadcast. Two of the four Cohans. I don't know if you know the movie, but Yankee Doodle Dandy. It was about the four Cohans. Well, I had two of them here at the firm, Larry and Josh, and it was a fantastic show talking about mass torts and a lot of really interesting topics. Talk about your team.
Well, we have a kind of unique team here. As you just said, we have some big teams at the firm. We have a construction team. We have a motor vehicle accident team. We have a Med-Mal team. And me and Drew are kind of our own small team. And we probably handle the most varied cases in the firm. We handle We handle construction accident cases. We handle truck accident cases. We handle premises cases. We handle some medical malpractice cases. We handle some dental malpractice cases. So we really kind of do the full gamut. So we're a small team, but we have a really varied practice.
Yeah, and I was doing a little research, Drew, and you do have a diverse background in cases you've handled. Does that help you, obviously, with the team?
Yeah, I think that versatility allows us to help a wide range of clients and people who need our help. And being not so specialized, it allows us to kind of sometimes look at cases a little differently and see different angles and preparation. And you know, it's also interesting and fun to work on because you're learning so many new things and different things. I joked early on, we used to have a case where our client was injured at a water park, working at a water park with a conveyor belt. And never did I think in a million years that I would have knowledge of how those things work and, right. and the intricacies of it. So it's interesting work, and it's and I enjoy that variety.
And I'm going to take a shot at this one, but you look like a soccer player. Huh? Am I a genius or what?
You are a genius.
Nailed it.
Talk about it. You know, I've had conversations where sports and the law, okay, those intangibles. You play soccer at Villanova?
Played is a loose – anybody listening that has Google, say playing is a loose term, but I was on the team, yes.
Right. Let me tell you, every time an iron worker listens to a show here, they're going, thank God he's talking. He's doing what he's good at. You know what I mean? But even having said that, you know, being in that environment, I've had the conversation in regards to athletics and the law and the intangibles that you learn. I mean, obviously teamwork, performing, all those things, just gritting it out. Those things come in handy, you know, every day when you come to work.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, using trial as an example, you know, the prep was like preseason.
Yeah.
You know, where you do the two-a-days and you have the long hours, but you don't mind it because you know that work is setting up for what you're doing. In this case, the prep was setting up for the trial. And there's a competitive aspect, you know, in our work, in the adversarial side of it and the preparation and you know, depositions and all of that. So I think there's a lot that kind of translates over from athletics, and you see a lot of attorneys who are former athletes or have that kind of mentality.
Sure.
Because, you know, you're used to the hard work, you're used to having to the time management, you're used to kind of having to do a little more to try and
performing.
And performing.
Yeah. And the competitive nature. We had a family tragedy about 6-7 years ago, and I remember I ran into my high school football coach at a banquet, and I said, those 100-yard gassers, coach, they're coming in handy right about now. And so, no question about it, that grit and determination. Also, you know, one of the things that life isn't every day, you know, it's not a cakewalk. Sometimes you got to dig down and rock and roll. What the firm here has done with, you know, the level of success. But I know that, you know, and I obviously have the opportunity to know a lot of the attorneys and you know, everybody's working their tail off and grinding, but also a great team atmosphere, so that there's so many resources in this building, in this, you know, on these floors. Got to be just a great advantage.
It is, and you know, we have a work hard and play hard kind of mentality here, and
kind of like the iron workers, for crying out. Maybe different definitions, but go ahead.
So when there's times when we got to work hard, and we work hard.
Sure.
I think for about 30 days straight, me and Drew worked every day, sometimes in the nights also, because we were going on trial, and that's okay. But yeah, there's times when we get some time to ourselves and have some fun, and we try to have a little balance.
Yeah, I mean, I'll tell you, in anything, in life, in your marriage and everything, balance is the in a lot of ways, one of the ultimate goals. I mean, obviously you're working hard, but you want to be able to balance that out so that you can, you know, obviously deal with stuff, you know, in a sensible way too much. But I mean, I'm sure you get into some of these cases, and that balance feels like it may not come anytime soon.
There's a time to work. There's a time to play.
So when you're dealing with a lot of these cases, you know, that the firm's got a national reputation, and a lot of these cases don't, no matter how obvious they are, over, you know, the client setting expectations, the communication and all those, how important is that? Because no matter how shut, opening shut the case seems to be to a client, the insurance companies aren't just, you know, rolling over, and you know, their logic is sometimes unexplainable. But talk about it, set how important setting expectation is to a client.
Well, it's very important because most cases aren't just open and shut.
Right.
And as you say, we're going to face a battle on some front in every case, whether it be liability or damages, and most likely both. So, you know, we do try to set those expectations when we start out with a client, because there's so many unknowns when you go into a case. There's so many. And so, you know, we try not to make promises about the results we're going to obtain with our clients. The only promise we make is we're going to work really hard.
Yep.
And, you know, do the best job we can. And that they understand that usually, and they're happy with that.
The culture at the firm of success and hard work. Talk about that. And, you know, because there's some serious, I mean, it's a serious place. And, you know, everybody's got their game face on. Talk about where that comes from, number one, and how you continue that process over the generations.
Yeah, the culture is really set by our leadership. And then, you know, really, Bob Mongaluzzi is our ultimate leader of this firm. And, you know, you probably know Bob a little bit.
Sure. But,
you know, Bob very much has that play hard and work hard mentality. You know, we work hard, of course, but we also have some fun. You mentioned sports. We have, you know, great tickets to every sports team in the city, and we use them for ourselves and for our clients. And we use them as we plan group events. We have group outings, and we golf together, and we get together at the shore together. You know, we do a lot of stuff to stay connected and have fun. It can't just be about work.
No question about it. One of the things, but you have teams here, and the cases that you deal with are often on a national level. I mean, you know, the duck boat cases, you know, a number of other national cases. I don't think it's like over a billion dollars in recoveries for clients. Now, you know, that when I talk about generations, I'm talking about generations of serious attorneys that are built the same way. In other words, if nobody's looking to get out of here on a Friday afternoon, if trial is next week, everybody's serious. How do you maintain that level of quality and, you know, what the teams expect of each other and themselves?
Well, you know, we have high expectations of ourselves. And like I was saying earlier, you know, there's a time when, you know, your entire focus has to be on a certain case and getting ready for trial. And if that means you're working Saturday and Sunday, that's okay. There'll be weekends where you'll get to play with your family or do some fun stuff or golf, but then there's certain weekends where, you know, the case comes first, and we accept that. It's part of the, you know, doing business and practicing this type of law, and you know, we understand that, our families understand that, and it's something we manage.
Drew, when you came to the firm has already obviously been successful. You know, you knew that, you know, you were going to be hitting it and getting it, and there's a standard here. Talk about that.
Absolutely. And I think what Ara touched on with the leadership, it's that in laying out that expectation as well. You know, when we're going back to this trial we're just on, it's not just me that's here early mornings, late nights. You know, it's Ara and it's Bob Mongaluzzi. You know, they talk about leaders. You know, I think it was George Washington where they said if his army had to walk, he got off his horse and he walked with them. And I think there's a lot of that. You're here on a weekend, you're having Larry Bendesky, Bob Mongaluzzi, you know, the partners are having, you have people in the office setting that expectation and setting that quality level. And it's a balance of they push you to make sure that you are meeting their expectations, but they also help you as well, you know.
And what's interesting is a lot of times it's David versus Goliath, you know, but not here. In other words, you guys walk in, Saltz Mongaluzzi Bendesky walks into the courtroom, and, you know, you're not just dealing with a firm that barely has the resources. You guys have the resources to fight against, you know, big insurance companies that can go on forever, and you never have to compromise with, you know, your clients. Talk about that.
Well, that's important because ultimately, you know, we're litigating against an individual or a company, but they're backed by a multi-billion-dollar insurance company. And they're hiring very big law firms, much bigger than our law firm as far as numbers and attorneys and resources. So fortunately, we can match that. You know, we have, you know, the resources to hire the best experts and get them into a courtroom. We have the resources to bring into the courtroom the type of trial technology you need today to really compete. And so that's really important because they know who's got the ability to really take the case to trial and try the kind of case that can win. And a lot of firms just don't have those resources. And fortunately, we do.
Well, you get a lot of cases from other firms. You know, they'll even across state lines. How often does that happen where other firms, obviously, they may be quality firms, but they may know that they don't have the resources to try that case?
Well, I can answer that. You know, a good percentage of our cases do come from other attorneys, you know, and most of the time they're really doing the best thing for their clients because they may be great attorneys, but they might not have the resources or, more importantly, even the expertise. Okay, to handle, you know, these types of cases. There aren't a lot of attorneys that are handling complex product liability cases on a routine basis, that are handling complex construction cases, complex med-mal cases on a routine basis. You know, they're really doing their clients a service by getting into a firm such as ours that does have that expertise and experience and the resources to handle it.
And the vetting process of a case, just the case itself, like the one that we're going to talk about in a little while, talk about sometimes what that, you know, just entails regarding whether you're going to take a case. You know, and sometimes, you know, you're going to spend money, whether, you know, trying to make a decision on whether you're going to do something.
Well, Drew gets involved a lot with that, so I'm going to let him answer that question.
Yeah, I think with a lot of those, it can be a pretty in-depth process of, and the one thing, you know, as Ara said, we don't make any promises or guarantees on a type of case, but the one thing when it comes in the door that we do promise is that we're going to take a good, fair, hard look at it and make a determination of whether, you know, it's something that we can take on and we can help with. And it's not limited to one person. You know, we've expanded a lot. I don't know the exact number of attorneys we have now, but, you know, the attorney that's doing the investigation process has the resource of all of those attorneys. You know, I could walk in to any attorney's office, ask, and if have a question, and they'll sit down and they'll go through their thoughts. And sometimes we have attorneys meetings with all of the attorneys together. And if we have questions involving things like the investigation of a case and their opinions as to theories of liability, if this is something we can take on, you know, we get the opinion of all of those attorneys. So when we do these investigations, while one attorney is spearheading it, it's the entire firm really is investigating.
And there are different factors that you're you know, obviously including in whether you can take a case, including, I guess, I mean, because you're trying to do a good job for the client. Obviously, it's going to, you know, there's going to be costs, which, by the way, you don't pass on to the client, certainly even in the vetting process. But, it's a contingency fee, which we'll talk about that later. But the point is, what are the factors that you look at before you take a case? Because some of these cases can be very expensive. especially you mentioned MedMal, is something that...
Yeah, MedMals are a little bit of a special animal. Because for a variety of reasons, there are some special rules and laws that apply only to MedMal, such as the venue rules, which is a really big factor. And because some of the MedMal cases can only be brought in the venue where the treatment at issue occurred. And so often, you'll find yourself in a very difficult, very conservative venue where they have a history of very poor results in medical malpractice trials. And MedMal cases are probably the most likely to actually go to trial for a whole variety of reasons. So, we have to look at them through a little different lens when we're evaluating them. But in general, we're looking for, can we establish liability against an entity that actually we can make a recovery against? So of course we got to look at is there liability, is there a defendant that we can actually get a judgment paid, does the damages picture warrant the kind of expenditure and resources and time for that type of case. And so there are a variety of factors, and sometimes we'll take a case just because we think it's the right thing to do, even though it's not always just about economics. We do some pro bono work, and we'll take on difficult cases sometimes just because we think it is an important point to be made by the litigation.
Let's talk about the wide array of cases that you guys represent. Construction cases. You talked about product liability, and then obviously a number of different areas. We're going to get into the case that we're going to discuss that you just represented, and it's a big one. But give me an idea of some of the different types of maybe name cases or big cases that the firm has represented that our listeners might recognize.
Well, what the firm has represented is the Philadelphia building collapse, which was back on 22nd and Market, I believe that
Salvation
was.
Salvation Army.
Onto the Salvation Army, our firm.
Ironically, that firm, just so you know, I come from the Philadelphia building trades. So Saltz Mangalusi has represented so many of our people. I mean, my dad ran the Ironworkers Union for 40 years, so I had heard the name Mangalusi about a million times, and he would only send, because as you can imagine, and by the way, I didn't work in Liberty 1, I worked a little on it, but Liberty 2, I started it, in the tip. So in other words, our guys don't get just a little hurt, you know what I mean? And so you guys have done a lot of stuff for us. The construction, that Salvation Army. What's crazy about that is the AFL-CIO is 50 yards from there. 50 yards, if I'm exaggerating, it might be less. Mm-hmm. And so that disgrace of what was going on right there, can't even imagine. But yet you guys represented that. The Tropicana, okay.
That was a big one.
The collapse of the
city. The garage.
The garage.
Yeah.
Okay, so that guy, Mike Whitland, was my boss on the Frankfurt L.
Wow.
Bob and Andrew Duffy had mentioned that was one of the first big cases. So there's a big connection here. That guy was one of the nicest guys you could ever meet in your life. I worked for him for 2 years on the Frankfurt L. We were refurbishing it. So believe me, I've seen up close what the firm can do. But continue the other types of...
Yeah, and you mentioned on the duck boat, both the Philly duck boat and then in Missouri from a few years back. And right now that we have people in the firm down in Miami working on the condominium that had collapsed as well.
Right.
And they're working very heavily and are taking the lead in that also.
So those type of cases... are catastrophic cases. You represent catastrophic cases, and there's a great responsibility in that. When they walk, how do you handle? And I'll ask you, how do you handle, in a sense, staying when somebody walks in that door, they're sitting right where I'm at right now. There's a good chance that either their loved one or they are either catastrophically injured and never be the same, or they're passed away. How do you maintain that kind of composure, in a sense, you know, throughout the process? Because you're representing somebody in the most emotional way possible. As soon as your phone rings, and obviously, same for Ara, you've been doing this a long time. How do you maintain that?
I think you just have to understand that your job is to maintain that composure. They're coming to you with, you know, what is the most catastrophic event in their lives. And, you know, they, what they're looking for is someone that will fight for them and they'll represent them. And we will do that. You know, when we are in court or dealing with defense counsel, we'll fight for them. We'll represent them, you know, as hard as you can. But then on the other side, there's a little bit where we need to take a step back from the emotional side, because there are sometimes tough decisions and tough conversations that need to be had, and we need to have that kind of more work hat on to be able to give them whatever recommendations or whatever advice it is that is best for them when removing the emotions out of it.
And in your career, you've had such great examples, you know, if individuals that are successful being able to handle that particular area of law. A lot of, you know, we have an injured workers program with the unions, and I can tell, you know, I remember one particular individual I called, and he was leaving town. He was an attorney. He just had enough. And, you know, being a great attorney is more than just knowing the law. It's being able to handle those other areas and as successfully when, in a sense, somebody just lost a loved one.
Joe, in this very room, I've met with people who have lost loved ones, you know, are terribly injured, their lives are turned upside down. And, you know, you got to start off with a little bit of empathy.
Oh, yeah.
And so, you know, we do that. And, you know, I think when we first meet clients, we try to get to know them a little bit. And just try to understand what they're dealing with, what they're going through, you know, try to show a little empathy with their situation. And then we get on into the legal stuff. But you got to start off on that personal level, I think, to, you know, make some connection with the clients. And most of the time, they're not thinking about money. They really want answers. They really want to try to understand what happened, why it happened. Can they prevent it from ever happening again? That's where most of our clients focus it is when we first engage with them.
And in both of your situations and the firm, and I can't think of a place where this makes more sense, change happens in the courtroom. And so whenever I hear a truck and it's going beep, 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 I know it's backing up. I know that was an attorney that made that happen, and that it was probably unfortunately a tragic accident. I imagine that aside from a great recovery that you can restore for somebody, they're never going to have their life together. Having that opportunity to affect change has to be so rewarding.
It is for us, and it's very important to our clients. Almost every client we have, they want to not have it happen again. And I think in many instances, we're successful in that regard.
Yeah.
I mean, the bottom line is, you know, money affects change, okay?
Absolutely.
And, you know, when you know, corporate America is a bottom dollar business. And if it becomes unprofitable to have a dangerous product or to have a dangerous condition or to have an unsafe practice in the way they build something or construct something, you know, that'll get the change affected.
Sure.
If they actually, if it becomes unprofitable. And so I think trial lawyers in general have been very successful in affecting changes for the better in our entire society.
What's amazing is that the contingency fee agreement, it's just unbelievable that you can walk into an office like this, and if you're have attorneys like yourselves in this firm represent somebody without pulling a dime out of your pocket. Otherwise, there's no chance people could afford attorneys like yourself. And so every time I think about it, I get goosebumps. I want to we're gonna skip the break, which we often do on these particular shows. We're speaking to R. Avrigan and Drew Heinold of Saltzmog Lucy Bendesky. R. is a partner with the firm, and Drew's an associate. Let's get into the case.
All right.
The case that, that...
We just tried.
You just tried, right?
Yes.
And let me just... a very, very interesting case. I read up on it. I didn't read the entire brief, but I got the gist of it. I know what the listeners are going to want to talk about. So, Winterstein versus McNeil, or Winterstein versus McNeil?
Winterstein.
Okay. So, here was the headline. Dollar store found liable for off-premise truck crash and $4.6 million personal injury verdict. I apologize. Personal injury verdict. That was the Legal Intelligencer.
Yes.
Talk about that.
You know, it's a very interesting case, and... And it was, like most cases, as we got into the case, it took on some different lives of its own. It's a pretty good example of why you name a lot of defendants when you file this type of case. I mean, it really just looked like a truck accident case. Our guy was a truck driver himself. There was a tractor trailer blocking the road he was trying to go down. Our guy was the kind of guy who helped people.
He got out and tried to help direct the guy, right?
And tried to help. The driver was in a very tough situation with his tractor trailer, trying to get into a very difficult spot. There were very small clearances, and as our guy was spotting him, It appears, in the final analysis, the truck driver made some type of error in the control of his vehicle and pulled it forward.
Instead of backwards,
or just didn't control the forward movement and crushed our guy into a fence. And he got injured really badly, crushed his pelvis, had some real serious injuries. And, at first blush, okay, it's a tractor trailer case and you sue the tractor trailer company and the driver. But as we were looking at it, something just seemed a little off. I remember Drew and I talking about it and just the position it was in. We didn't have much information about the facility. It was a Family Dollar store they were delivering to. But we just had a sense that something didn't seem right. So we named the Family Dollar entities. And sure enough, it turned out there was a whole lot more to the story.
Very interesting. And certainly, when I was reading a little bit about it, and I'm assuming that somebody at the Family Dollar store, made a careless comment and said, no, you can't use the loading dock. You go do it over there. Because who could possibly imagine why somebody would do that? Am I in the ballpark?
You're in the ballpark. What it actually turned out to be is that the designers of the facility had designed it so that tractor trailers never had to make the maneuver that this guy was trying to make when he hit our client. It was designed so there would need to be no reversing maneuvers at all. And they had a loading zone where all it required was a forward movement along the side of the store to make the delivery. As we dug deeper and deeper, the story unfolded. They actually got a zoning variance to allow them to do this, Family Dollar. And there was all kinds of documents confirming that.
So they knew that there was a problem there if they didn't have it. Otherwise, they wouldn't have done that.
Well, the designers, I think, foresaw the limitations of the space and the envelope and designed a way to do this safely. Incredibly, even though it was designed that way and Family Dollar was aware of it and actually got a zoning variance to allow it, word never got to the people at the store that this is the way you're supposed to do your deliveries. And so you're right in that the store were directing tractor trailer drivers, including the guy involved in our accident, to pull into this rear alley area where there really wasn't sufficient space and envelope to make that maneuver safely. you know, that became the focus of the case. So it transitioned from a tractor trailer case to a premises liability case, really, and an operations case. And so, you know, these cases take on a life of their own, and you really never know which direction they're going to take you. And so we tried a very different case than what it looked like the day
when we
accepted it. That's right.
Drew, talk about the injuries that the individual had.
Yeah, these were really serious injuries to Brian, and they were when the truck crushed him, it separated his pelvis from his spine and separated, I guess, the bottom part of his pelvis that needed significant surgeries, you know, and that has had and continues to have a major impact in his life, you know, pain and difficulty with walking, and he was ultimately not able to return to work, which, you know, in terms of injuries, though, I think one of the biggest things is, you know, as Ara said, he's a guy that liked to help people. And I think the biggest damage for him in that case was this took away his purpose in life and his ability to, you know, to go out and help people, whether it was when he used to be with the fire department or in search and rescue. He's now, that's kind of been taken away from him, which I think was, you know, one of those things that's very hard to value, but it's very important. And I think it's very important for clients that we recognize those and we, you know, we fight for acknowledgement of those things.
It certainly, that isn't a stretch, because he literally got out and tried to help the guy. And who were the defendants in the case?
So the defendants were the trucking company and the driver, and then the Family Dollar entities that owned the property and operated the property.
And how long did the case two of them settled, right?
Well, yeah, probably one of the most interesting aspects of the case is it was strategic, okay? We had the trucking company and the truck driver as a defendant, and we had the store owners, Family Dollar, as a defendant. And the trucking company, approached us, towards the end of the litigation, and they wanted to make a settlement. And these are important strategic attorney decisions for attorneys to make, whether to settle with a defendant, because there's a lot of implications of that. When you settle with one defendant and go to trial against another defendant, that's going to have a big effect on the trial. Okay, the defendant that you did not settle with is going to blame it all on the defendants you did settle with. You know that's coming. We knew that was coming, and that's what we faced at trial. So you really have to think that through. Can we try this case successfully against just this defendant when they're going to be blaming it all on another defendant that probably isn't going to do very much to defend themselves because they've settled.
They've already settled, right?
That's right. So that was an important strategic decision. We felt that we could successfully try the case against Family Dollar alone, even knowing that they were going to blame it all on the trucking company and the truck driver. And that was a strategic decision. It's a tough decision for attorneys to make, and they really better think it through, and we did. We felt we could successfully try the case against Family Dollar alone, and that's what we did. And they did try to blame the entire case on the trucking company and their driver, but we felt we had a good case against them alone, and fortunately the jury saw it that way in the end.
And brag about himself,
right.
But there were some strategic decisions early on that, were spearheaded by Ara that foresaw the opportunity of potentially working, you know, being able to settle out with one and not the other, that he aligned the case in a way which it was almost litigating two separate cases. So once we were able to settle with the one, he was able to turn all of the attention on the other. And that was something that, you know, while this was settled at the end, this was something that Ara, with his experience, was able to see at the potential of early on and set the case up to allow us to do that.
Yeah. And the most important thing, I appreciate that, Drew, but the most important thing to do that, to effectuate that, is to get experts against, separate experts against each defendant. Because you can decide not to call an expert against the defendant you settled with. In many instances, experts will comment on all the various defendants, and that poses a problem if you go to trial in this scenario where you've settled with a defendant or two. So we try to make that a practice in most of our cases. If we foresee that type of situation, we'll get separate experts against each defendant.
Sure. I want to remind our listeners that you listened to the Saltz, Mongoluzzi, Bendeski Hour. R. Avergan and Drew Heinold are our guests. R. is a partner here at the firm, and Drew is an associate. And we're talking about a very interesting case where an individual who tried to help a trucker navigate into a position of trying to make a delivery, and he got catastrophically injured and crushed. And the actual headline, and I want to just say it one more time: Dollar Store found liable for off-premise truck crash and $4.6 million personal injury verdict. Who testified in the case?
Well, we called the representatives of Family Dollar. They were actually our first witnesses. We called them. We called an expert, obviously, against Family Dollar. We called our client. We called a number of medical experts. We called four different physician medical experts. Trial today really has to be visual. Okay, I think in today's world, we're trained to learn by seeing, just by how much TV we look at, so many computers. You know, we're always looking at something.
Sure.
You know, back when I first started trying cases, we hardly presented anything visually. A couple little poster boards we would have, but those days are gone. If you want to effectively try a case, you really got to present it in a visual format.
Sure.
And so we had some great visual medical visuals done by a company called Precise, and we took the actual film, CT scans and MRIs, and enhanced them to really so that
people, you know, could see the actual,
they could actually see the injuries on the actual films done on our client, and I think that was important and effective.
Oh. Can't imagine. Wasn't there like an aha moment where one of the individuals testifying on the defense side said that there was a, admitted that, you know, there was sort of a problem, to say the least.
Yeah. Bob Mongoluzzi did one of the greatest cross examinations I've ever seen of the Family Dollar corporate representative, and got him to admit that their conduct was unacceptable, was a complete failure, that it was just unacceptable behavior, and it was a complete failure. And I forget some of the other words.
Well, I get the picture, though. Yeah. That must have been like, you know, like a hold on, you know, an aha moment. You know, when you can get somebody to, you know, clearly admit that, you know, obviously there was a huge mistake made on their behalf.
It was a big moment, but their response was that their conduct didn't make a difference because it's the truck driver makes the decisions about where to deliver, when to deliver, how to deliver, and whether even he's going to choose to deliver. While they pretty much admitted their conduct was improper, it was pretty much a causation defense that, you know, this is the truck driver's responsibility, not ours.
And how did you prove that was obviously not the case?
I would say we proved it by connecting their conduct to the decisions that were made by the truck driver.
Right.
You know, ultimately, that was the real dispute in the case, whether they had any responsibility or it was all the truck driver's responsibility.
Did they give him directions and say, you know, go in this direction?
They did.
Okay, that's a different ballgame.
Right. And, you know, ultimately, that was what the dispute was at trial. Did they have any responsibility? They felt no. We felt yes. And sometimes you need juries to decide those issues.
True. When you're making, it sounds like you're going through this case, and there may, how early in the investigations did you get a chance to kind of depose the individuals who worked at the store to because that's a big deal. Them admitting it, obviously they didn't say go around back to the truck to the loading dock or do this. Or what point during that process did you guys realize that conduct was what it was?
It was a little bit of the ways in the process of how the case kind of comes to be is you do your investigation, make the decision whether you're going to take a case on or not. Then you file a complaint, which lays out your allegations against all the defendants, which R had mentioned is why it's a good practice to and a good example of naming as many defendants as you feel could be liable. Then you go through written discovery where there's exchange of information and papers, and that's when we first really kind of got a full picture of the Family Dollar having this loading zone that, hey, maybe this is more of a premises case, and then we get into being able to ask the questions in the deposition.
In a common sense factor, I'm going to assume that you saw the property. Like, why was he doing whatever maneuver he was making, why wasn't he just going to the loading dock?
Well, you know, that's a good question. And really, no, that wasn't obvious. And because there was no signage, there was nothing that would indicate that the side of the store was the loading zone. It wasn't obvious at first. We went out there. We were there. I've been there multiple times. And there's nothing that jumps out at you to say, no, the loading zone's on the side. You shouldn't be pulling in the rear. So as Drew said, it wasn't until we really started getting into the documents and the planning documents and the design documents that we really got a picture of what was going on.
So early on during the case, obviously you knew you had a case against the trucker and the trucking company. How much later did you I know you brought those other entities in, but at what point did you realize, okay, this is a whole different ballgame? We brought them in as a formality. Now we understand there's a major issue here.
It was the day I looked at the design document and saw there's a loading zone designed on the side.
Wow.
And, you know, that happens in every case. Most cases will turn down to one or two pieces of paper.
Wow.
I can remember, you know, when you get these documents, they give you thousands of them, and you got to spend, or at least hundreds in many cases, and you got to spend the hours digging through them, and typically you'll find one or two which end up making or breaking your case. And to me, it was when we pulled up the design, finally got to the design documents that they had produced, and saw that, oh, there's a design tractor trailer loading zone on the side of the store. And that was the second I realized, okay, we got a case against Family Dollar.
Yeah, because obviously there's a loading zone there for a reason. You know, otherwise everybody be pulling up out front and loading there. I mean, the zoning, I'm sure that the zoning code required it. And so if you're not using it, that's that can be a major problem. Talk about what it was like and what is it like? How long did the case take?
We were on trial for 8 days.
No, I don't mean that. I'm talking about from the day they came into the office to the day you brought it to fruition.
I think
over 4 years.
Wow.
Over 4 years.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
And talk about, what it's like when you're actually, in the trial. You talk about that athletic background and also, that competitiveness that you have here, getting out there on, listen, I don't think there's a problem with, I'm sure your team has a lot of researchers and things, but, being out there and being the trial lawyers that you are, the game's on. It's like your Super Bowl right then and there, except for one thing. You waited 4 years for your game. It's not every year. It's got to be a massive feeling when you're out there and you know that it's coming down to, this.
Yeah, the adrenaline is going when you're on trial. I mean, you're up early, you're going to bed late, and you're not sleeping a lot because there's so much going on in your head.
Tell the family just to chill.
Oh, yeah. The families take a little brunt, too,
Yeah.
You're not around a lot for a couple weeks, but they understand that. But it is like Bob Mongluzzi calls it showtime.
Yeah.
And to a degree it is. You know, we 4 years comes down to those 8 days in that courtroom, 4 years of work. And like Drew said, it's preparation is what really makes it successful. You know, if you're not ready, that'll be a rough 8 days of trial. It'll be frantic and stressful and difficult. But if you are ready, you can handle it. It's not as bad. You can focus on doing a good job.
The performing factor in regards to being in front of that jury, what do they say about somebody? You know, they talk about how that most people, you know, would rather be dead than speak in public, right? And that way, I forget what comedian said it, but Jerry Seinfeld, when he said that means more people would prefer to be in the casket than actually giving the eulogy, right? When you're out there and you're given and you know you're given your you're doing your thing out there, likely you're not looking at, you know, just at a piece of paper all the, you know what I mean, I'm sure you have to do some referencing. What is that like? Because I'm assuming that it's not just something that you can, you know, just teach. It's about performing when you're out there.
Yeah, listen, I think most trial attorneys get a little nervous before trial, get some butterflies.
Sure.
I had a father who was a judge and tried a lot of cases, and he told me, you know, the day he didn't get nervous speaking in court is the day he was going
to
hang up his work shoes. I think everybody gets a little bit nervous. But once you start talking and working and focusing, you know, you get comfortable and focus on the job at hand. You know, Drew's a little bit younger attorney, but and you know, this was a pressure-packed trial, he agreed to take a witness on and do a witness and do a he did a great job. Maybe you can tell us about how that went.
I appreciate him saying that. I mean, I when I was offered the opportunity, of course I was going to take it. That's what we do this job for. But no, it was a great experience to be able to take one of those on, and the added pressure of your two bosses.
Well, I was just going to say that.
Yeah.
They just hit home runs. Your term, no big deal. We've got about $4 million on the line here.
Bob Mongluzzi gets representative to say that,
all right.
You know, the Jack
corporate
Nicholson. Failures, and then I come up. No, but it was a good experience, and you know, to have you know, not just Ara and Bob being supportive, and you know, I was able to ask them questions of things, how they would approach it. You know, there was other attorneys, because you know, Ara and Bob were having to prepare for other things. I was able to pick some brains, and you know, I think it sounds like it went well. It's good to
you're still
to
here.
Hear that.
You're still here.
He did fine. He did fine.
That's awesome. So. It always reminds me of you know, Tom Cruise and A Few Good Men, and you know, and they're sitting there going, "Don't do it." Everything's on the line. But that's awesome, and having that trust that your bosses have in you, and coming through. Well, I'm sure in your case, Ara, you wouldn't hesitate again, because he did a good job. I'm sure even the next time, or when you're doing that, you've got that under your belt, man.
Yeah, no, me and Drew have tried cases before, and he did a good job, and I knew he can handle it, and he did well. But you know, as I said earlier, this was a high stakes case, and you know, for a young attorney to be up there in trial in a high stakes case in front of his two bosses, I've been there. That's harder.
Yeah,
when you're the lead attorney, you know, it's your show, and you don't have that added pressure of you know,
plus you have a track
record. Bosses,
right.
Yeah, you know, breathing down your neck. So, but I knew he could handle it. He did well.
Awesome.
And I think that just also goes back to the culture that they build. You know, of you talk about different generations of attorneys that are able to do this. Is part of it is allowing,
right,
you know, the young attorneys to be involved. And the other thing that the firm is great and supportive of is they allow us to go through an LLM, which is a legal master's degree in trial advocacy.
Right.
And our firm, I believe, has the most attorneys with LLMs in trial advocacy in the country.
Wow.
Because they're so supportive to allow us to get that practice, so that when we do get into these situations,
okay,
we're reared up ready to
go. So we talk about a little while ago, we only got a couple minutes left. This has been awesome. we talk about how this firm culture continues to multiply and move forward, and that's really it right there. You bring young attorneys, you're paying it forward, you're rocking and rolling the same exact way it was given to you, Ara, and that to me is what this firm's all about. You continue that track record of excellence. And now, I mean, you know, you're because these are huge cases, and that's a big deal.
Yeah, I think at some firms, young attorneys get just stuck in a library and they're just researching and writing papers, and we really don't want that. We don't encourage that here. I can remember when I was a young lawyer here, they'd give me something to do, and I'd have 50 questions about it. They let me try a case when I was just here a few months. And I remember Bob Mongaluzzi would say to me, just go be a lawyer, which is kind of funny. Just go be a lawyer was his big advice to me. And it was good. He put me out there. And we try to do that with our young attorneys.
Awesome. We got about 3 minutes left. What was the result of talk about what it was like real quick in regards to the jury coming back and the victory must have been incredible.
That's a tense moment when that jury comes back. I mean, like this case, you live with it for 4 years.
4 years, man. It's like going to college and finding out if you got your degree or not, except right. Somebody else's life's on the line.
Whether you passed, So that's a tense moment when a jury comes back. And, they came back with a $4.6 million verdict. And, more importantly, they hit the family dollar for a large portion of the liability, more than half. We were able to make a real good recovery for our client, and it's really going to help him. It's going to take care of him for the rest of his life, and he needs it, and he deserves it. His life got turned upside down, and I'm real happy for him.
Awesome. Well, listen, gentlemen, it's been the fastest hour in radio. You guys are awesome. Ara Avragan and Drew Heinold of Saltz Mongaluzzi. Ara, if you will, contact, if somebody wanted to get in touch with you at the firm or...
Sure, they can call me directly. My number's 215-575-2971, or you can always email me also. I have a pretty easy email. It's my first name, Ara, A-R-A at smbb.com, and be happy to answer any questions anybody might have. Happy to lend a hand in any cases they might have, advice, or if somebody needs our help, happy to give it a shot.
Awesome. And Drew, any parting words?
I appreciate you letting us come on and talk about this. It was from a young lawyer perspective. It was a great opportunity, and as Ara, mentioned, it was a pleasure representing such an awesome client.
Awesome. Well, listen, I want to thank everybody for tuning in to the Saltz Mongaluzzi Bendeschi Hour on WWDB Talk 860. I want to thank Ara Avragan, partner here at Saltz Mongaluzzi Bendeschi, and of course associate Drew Heinold for being fantastic guests. And of course, I want to thank all of our listeners for tuning in. On behalf of Ara and Drew and everybody here at Saltz Mongaluzzi Bendeschi, I'm Joe Dougherty.
Thanks for having us, Joe.
Yeah, thank you.
Have a great day.
All right.